From MainePublic.org, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, October 4th, 2016. And on this day, the Clinton campaign says Donald Trump's reported losses on his 1995 federal income tax return equate to what nearly 60,000 Mainers paid in federal income tax 2 years ago. There was vivid testimony today from survivors of a Portland fire that killed six people 2 years ago as the manslaughter trial of the building's owner continues. And Maine drug agents are on track this year to bust a record number of meth labs. Those stories and more after this. This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and Kennebec Valley Community College, offering a late start semester beginning September 26th. kvcc.me.edu. I'm Barbara Caridi. Nearly 500,000 Maine households paid federal income taxes 2 years ago, according to the most recent IRS statistics. The number provides some local context to recent revelations that Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump could have avoided paying any federal income tax for nearly two decades after he claimed a nearly $1 billion business loss. As Steve Missler reports, Hillary Clinton's campaign is hoping the controversy will erode Trump's support in battleground states, including in Maine.
Overall, the IRS reports that Maine households owed close to $4 billion in federal income tax 2 years ago, before refunds. That's almost four times what Trump claimed in casino and other investment losses on his 1995 tax return, according to records obtained by the New York Times. Trump, who is attempting a historic split of Maine's four electoral votes, canceled an appearance in Portland scheduled for Thursday. But that didn't stop Clinton's Maine campaign from localizing the tax revelations. In a press release, the campaign equates Trump's reported losses to what close to 60,000 Mainers paid in federal income tax 2 years ago. Meanwhile, Clinton ripped her rival at a rally in Akron, Ohio, targeting the Republican's oft-touted image as a successful businessman.
And, you know, yesterday some of his supporters said, well, it just shows he's a genius that he didn't pay any taxes. Well, what kind of genius loses $1 billion in the first place?
Trump stuck to his defense at a rally in Colorado. He said the federal tax laws are complex and unfair, but that he understands them and is therefore the right candidate to fix them.
The unfairness of the tax laws is unbelievable. It's something I've been talking about for a long time, despite, frankly, being a big beneficiary of the laws. But I'm working for you now. I'm not working for Trump. Believe me.
Trump also recently said that he's smart for tilting the tax system to his advantage. Over the past several years, he has complained that the wealthy shoulder the brunt of the country's tax burden. And he's criticized President Obama's tax rate. 4 years ago, he tweeted, quote, "Over half of Americans don't pay income tax, despite crippling government debt." Now, Trump is blaming the political establishment for a tax code full of loopholes, from which he says he's benefited.
All at the behest of their favorite donors and special interests who want certain provisions put in, and they won't take no for an answer.
Trump has refused to release his taxes, citing the fact that he's under audit, so it's unclear what he currently pays, or whether he took advantage of the so-called carry-forward provision that allows real estate developers to claim big losses and avoid paying taxes. The real estate lobby has fought hard to secure such exemptions in the federal tax code. It spent nearly $100 million lobbying Congress 2 years ago, according to data compiled by the Center for Responsive Politics. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Meanwhile, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders will hold a rally in Maine Friday for Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Sanders' visit to Bangor comes as Clinton attempts to regain ground against Republican Donald Trump in Maine's 2nd congressional district. Recent polls show that Trump is leading in that rural, more conservative congressional district, but Sanders has performed well here, too. He handily defeated Clinton during the Democratic caucuses, and his message about income inequality and foreign trade deals has appealed to rural voters. Sanders has backed Clinton since losing the nomination and campaigned for her as she attempts to unify Democratic voters. Sanders is also the second Clinton surrogate to appear in Maine, following polls showing that Trump could win one of Maine's four electoral votes. Such a split has never happened since Maine became one of two states to allow candidates to pick up an electoral vote if they win in either of the state's two congressional districts. The Sanders rally will be held at Bangor's Cross Insurance Center. It's scheduled to begin at 10:30 in the morning. And in Augusta, lawmakers and public health advocates are demanding answers from Governor Paul LePage's administration about why it discontinued the Healthy Maine Partnerships Program and how it plans to transition to a centralized approach to health education. The Portland Press-Herald reports that the 27 agencies that were part of the coalition had their contracts terminated last week. They were told that five agencies will subcontract to local agencies for public health education. Department of Health and Human Services spokeswoman Samantha Edwards says the changes don't represent a reduction in health prevention services or funding. State officials say the new, more centralized approach will be an improvement over the localized organization of Healthy Maine Partnerships. But advocates say the move is puzzling. They say the partnerships were effective. And in Portland today, the trial continued for former landlord Gregory Nisbet, who is facing manslaughter charges in a November 2014 fire that killed six city residents. Nisbet was the owner of the building, and if he's convicted, it would be the first time in the state's history that a landlord is convicted for manslaughter in a tenant death stemming from negligent building operation. Nisbet faces up to 30 years in prison if convicted. Maine Public Radio's Fred Bever was at the trial today, and he talks with Nora Flaherty.
Fred, thanks for joining me.
You bet.
So give me some background here.
It was the deadliest fire in 40 years in Maine. It happened the day after Halloween 2 years ago. 20 and 24 Noyes Street was a building occupied by a lot of young people, students, bartenders, some doing odd jobs, some who were seeking sobriety together. They pooled resources to pay rent, electricity, and heat. And early that morning, a porch fire started by smoking materials got out of control, and the fire moved fast. Some escaped, but five didn't, and a sixth died from his burns a few days later.
And the state says that landlord Gregory Nisbet is to blame.
That's right. Prosecutors are citing evidence that smoke alarms were out of commission, a stairwell was blocked by furniture, and the third floor bedrooms lacked a second exit, which put the residents into a death trap after the main stairway was engulfed with flames. And prosecutors say the building should have met code standards for a rooming house, which would mean not only that smoke alarms should be in working order, but there should have been more and a more robust fire security system all around. Nisbet knew all that, they say, and he didn't care enough to do anything about it.
And the defense?
Well, they say under city regulations, the building wasn't a rooming house, but it was a single-family dwelling, which requires lower fire safety standards. And they're also suggesting the fire was moving so fast, with a plume of noxious gases in front, that the building's condition or modes of egress weren't the fatal factors.
So tell me what happened in the courtroom today.
So today was the first full day of testimony in Cumberland County Court. Nisbet waived his right to a jury trial, by the way, so it is being heard by Justice Thomas Warren alone. It was all prosecution witnesses today. They included people who escaped the fire, some previous tenants, and a couple of contractors who'd worked on the place for Nisbet. Most of it seemed designed to establish that Nisbet neglected the place, that he knew it was unsafe, that it lacked the proper permits. But the most vivid testimony came from a survivor who described how his run to safety was blocked by a bookcase in a stairway, and then how once he did get out, another survivor told him that three of their friends, quote, "they didn't make it, bro." That was quite a moment. And one witness, a clerk at a Midcoast tennis club, was brought in to testify that the day of the fire, Nisbet took his usual doubles appointments there, even after learning that one of his tenants had died. That drew some gasps of outrage from victims' friends and family who were in the audience. On cross-examination, though, that clerk confirmed that once Nisbet learned that several had died, he did seem upset.
How else did the defense respond?
By trying to elicit evidence, Nora, that the tenants saw themselves and acted as a family, which some said testified that they did. And so that goes towards the question of whether the place was really a rooming house or a single-family dwelling. As the defense hopes the judge will see it, they tried to undermine the credibility of one contractor who testified that he'd warned Nisbet years ago that the building's top floor windows looked too small to meet code. And they also asked the survivors whether they'd been drinking the night before the fire, which those who testified said they hadn't. We may hear more from the defense about that soon. It looks like the prosecution could be finished with its witnesses by tomorrow.
And how are the survivors and their friends and family holding up?
Of course, this is stirring up awful memories for them, and the tragedy's two-year anniversary is just a few weeks away. But Ashley Summers, whose husband died after escaping the house, she told me she's got faith in the judicial system and that what she's really looking forward to, more than a guilty verdict, is a memorial service that's planned for October 30th.
Okay, thanks, Fred.
Thank you, Nora.
And that was Fred Bever talking with Nora Flaherty. Coming up, Maine closes mudflats down east after discovering a shellfish neurotoxin. And it's shaping up to be a record-setting year in Maine for meth lab busts. Maine's worsening heroin and opioid addiction crisis has dominated the headlines, but the state's drug enforcement community is also chasing a growing methamphetamine problem. Officials say they're on track to double the number of meth lab busts this year. Mal Leary reports.
So far this year, authorities have uncovered more than 100 meth labs, or debris from former operations, across the state. That's nearly twice as many as last year. And a decade ago, it would have been just five or six. And unlike the complex home manufacturing system portrayed in the popular cable TV show Breaking Bad, most meth labs in Maine are relatively simple.
Everybody thinks methamphetamine is produced in those labs. It's not. It's produced in soda bottles. It's produced in 1-liter bottles, 2-liter bottles. And those are more volatile and more dangerous than those Breaking Bad labs.
Matt Cashman is a supervisor with the Maine Drug Enforcement Agency that leads a team of agents that respond to meth labs. The drug, he explains, is made from easily available ingredients, including pseudoephedrine, contained in allergy medicines. It's what's called the shake-and-bake method. Ingredients are placed in a container with lithium from a battery you might find in your flashlight, and the chemicals generate heat as they react to make the meth. Cashman says the lithium can cause an explosion from contact with water, and if improperly mixed, can cause part of the bottle to melt, shooting out a flame several feet as it whirls around.
Lithium will catch fire, and it burns as hot as a sparkler, burns as hot as a flare.
Cashman says at one meth lab cleanup site in a crowded apartment, acid from a container spilled on his protective suit as he bagged evidence. He was decontaminated at the scene in a mobile unit that is also dispatched to every incident. MDEA Director Roy McKinney says the bulky suits provide critical protection, but also put a toll on the agents.
You put yourself in one of these chemical-resistant suits on a hot or even a cold winter's day, and it fatigues them, to say the least.
And the labs can be found anywhere. Cashman says that earlier this year, agents followed a suspect from Damariscotta along U.S. Route 1 and watched him pull in behind a gas station for about a half hour. They then followed his car to the parking lot behind a big box store in Brunswick, where he was arrested.
What he had done is he had completed the entire process, the manufacturing, adding all the chemicals at the Irving station, and was driving down Route 1 while it cooked off in 45 minutes. And ultimately what his intent to do was to use the hydrogen chloride gas and salt it out and make his product in the parking lot of Lowe's.
Cashman says if he had not been caught, the toxic waste from the mobile lab would likely have been discarded in the dumpster behind the store. Specially trained staff from the Department of Environmental Protection are sent to these incidents to clean up all that hazardous waste once the evidence gathering is over. And other responders are also brought in, including law enforcement officers maintaining security around the area, and emergency medical personnel and firemen standing by in case of an explosion or fire. MDA's Warry McKinney says it can get expensive.
The worst case scenario, on a weekend, everyone's on overtime, over $10,000 for one lab seizure response.
McKinney says MDEA will spend on average $4,000 to $5,000 for its costs at every incident. Sometimes local police and emergency agencies are reimbursed for its work, but not always. A lab discovered in Brewer last spring cost the city $1,500, above the $1,700 that was billed to MDEA. Robert Shannon supervises a Bangor-based response team for the Department of Environmental Protection.
Eventually, you are paying for every single one pot, every single bottle that has lithium and baby oil or mineral oil in it. Yes, it's thousands of dollars.
For every pound of meth produced in these small labs, 5 to 6 pounds of hazardous waste is generated. The state pays for disposal by weight, and Shannon says costs have been reduced thanks to the creation of a short-term hazardous waste storage facility to hold the neutralized hazardous materials, which are taken away by an independent contractor every 3 months. But MDEA's McKinney says if the meth lab problem continues to grow, the agency may have to seek funding for staff who are dedicated to the meth problem. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Meanwhile, Maine's Department of Marine Resources has closed mudflats along the entire Down East coast after routine tests detected the presence of a marine neurotoxin that could affect softshell clams, mussels, and mahogany quahogs. Jeff Nichols, a DMR spokesman, said the department has issued a recall on clams harvested between September 25th and September 30th. He says the mudflat closure affects all shellfish harvesting areas between Otter Point on Mount Desert Island east to the Canadian border.
We're very confident that through the recall and the closure that we've taken all the necessary steps to prevent any of the impacted shellfish from entering the supply chain. We definitely take it seriously.
Although no cases of sickness have been reported, Nichols said anyone who has eaten clams harvested during the time period in question should contact a healthcare provider if they believe they're experiencing symptoms associated with amnesic shellfish poisoning. Those symptoms include gastrointestinal distress, seizures, weakness, and paralysis. And Maine police say a 3-year-old girl has been located after an Amber Alert that included the first notifications on cell phones as well as notifications on local TV channels. Police had said the youngster, Lenore Wilson, was believed to be with an Augusta woman who occasionally cared for her. Police say the girl was last seen in an Augusta apartment Monday night when there was a medical emergency involving her mother, who was hospitalized. Police say the girl was located late this afternoon and taken to the Augusta Police Department. No further details were immediately available. Meanwhile, authorities in Maine are asking for the public's help as they investigate the third sinking of a Tennant's Harbor lobsterman's boat in 2 months. The most recent sinking of the 35-foot Liberty, owned by Anthony Hooper, happened sometime between the evening of September 30th and the morning of October 1st. Each incident occurred in Port Clyde, where the boat is moored.
The Marine Patrol is working with the Knox County Sheriff's Office to investigate.
That's Marine Patrol spokesman Jeff Nichols. Nichols wouldn't discuss possible motives. He says that's part of the investigation. Nichols says the patrol is encouraging those with any information about the sinking to contact their local Marine Patrol officer or the state police. He says the Operation Game Thief program is offering a yet-to-be-specified reward for information that leads to prosecution in the case. And as temperatures fall, heating prices are going up. No surprise there. The governor's energy office's survey conducted yesterday found that on average, the price for heating oil rose 5 cents over the past week to $1.93 per gallon. Kerosene prices have also risen 5 cents to $2.45 a gallon, while propane prices have increased 1 cent to $2.19. And meteorologist Paul Cousins tells us how much we might have to crank up that heat in the coming days.
We are now gliding serenely into a most delightful segment of fall weather. The drought issues notwithstanding, the last vestiges of low cloudiness will finally dissolve tonight across the mountains and the foothills. Starless skies late throughout all of Maine. Temperatures drop into the 40s, 30s in some of the interior secluded hollows. For the remainder of the work week, sunshine will be abundant, if not completely unchallenged. Temperatures will slowly creep higher and higher. Tomorrow, 66 to 72 north to south. Thursday, 68 to 76 north to south, and well into the 70s Friday and Saturday. The exception, shore roads will max out in the 60s every day thanks to sea breezes. Saturday will still be pleasant, and then Matthew will arc off the eastern seaboard once it trounces Cape Hatteras. The trend is to track the storm south of New England, yet we must not drop our guard yet. We certainly could use a drought quencher. Cooler weather will follow the hybrid storm, in fact, a little bit chillier than normal by early next week. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public.
And that's the news on This Day in Maine, Tuesday, October 4th, 2016. Robert Holt composed our theme music. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Steve Missler, Fred Bever, Mal Leary, A.J. Higgins, Nora Flaherty, and Ed Morin for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mainepublic.org. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public, thanks for listening.